States Inc. 21 AP 1054. Could I please have your appearances?
Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, and you've been admitted?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Good morning. 25 minutes followed by 30, 5 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Section 893.587 is an extraordinary expansion of the repose period that needs to be strictly interpreted. The legislature allowed a claimant up to 35 years of age to assert very limited, enumerated claims that are explicitly and unambiguously set forth in that statute. It is limited to the perpetrator of a sexual assault on a minor. That was the legislative intent, that was the legislative language, and that was the piece of legislation that was passed and is applicable today. It's strictly limited to those groups, that perpetrator, and no other groups, no other perpetrator. We will talk in a little bit about the legislative history. There was some expansion for, again, a very limited, narrow construct for religious organizations that employ the clergy. That is not directly applicable here, but it is very instructive and useful, which we will talk about in a few minutes. While Section 587 permits the victims of child sexual assault to file actions against abusers until the party reaches the age of 35, this does not apply to Fleming's actions against AAU, which is a secular, voluntary, nonprofit organization. We start by the plain reading of Section 893.587. This court has stated that the courts have stated that we begin with the plain, unambiguous statutory language. The words used by the legislature are to be given their common, ordinary, and accepted meaning. WSSTAT 587, by its very terms, applies only to acts that constitute a violation of certain enumerated sections. And the two sections that are applicable here today are 984.02, which is sexual assault of a child, and 948.025, which are three or more sexual assaults of a child. But again, the statute is limited to the perpetrator, in this case, a Mr. Kincaid.
I don't see anything in the statute that limits its application only against the direct perpetrator of the act.
It is by the language of the statute, Your Honor. The statute defines an act, an action, whereby an act would constitute a violation of the five enumerated statutes.
Before that, it says injuries caused by an act.
Correct. And that is talking about the injuries caused by the act of the perpetrator. That you have to read the entire statute in its context.
Well, right. Exactly. I don't know how you can read this. An action to recover damages for injury caused by an act that would constitute a violation of either child sexual assault or repeated acts of sexual assault. Nothing in there says that it has to be something that was directly committed by the perpetrator.
Each one of those statutes are limited to the perpetrator.
I'm very familiar with 948.02 and 948.025, trust me. I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about the two phrases that precede that in 893.587.
The two phrases that precede that are simply defining what can be recovered by actions against those perpetrators. There would be no purpose to enumerate each of these individual statutes that, again, are only limited to perpetrators if it was opened up to non-perpetrators of sexual assault.
Yeah, I'm not.
How about an action? How about that as being pretty broad? We're talking about an action to recover damages for injury caused by an act that would constitute a violation of. It doesn't say an action against the perpetrator of. It doesn't specify the type of action, which it certainly could. Negligent supervision, negligent hiring, those are types of actions to recover damages for what type of injury? The injury caused by an act that would constitute a violation of those sections.
Your Honor, an action is just that, an action. It does not say any and all actions. It does not say all-inclusive actions. It does not say negligence. The action is defined by the act that would constitute a violation of these three sections, because if you interpret that with the second clause, it would also read an action that would create a cause of action under Section 895.442. The action is not defining the damage. The action is not defining the injury. The action is defined by the act, the limited specific act that the legislature inserted.
Except that those criminal statutes are criminal, they're criminal liability. Someone isn't bringing an action for those violations under those criminal statutes because that's brought by the state. So we're back to an action to recover damages for what type of injury? The injury that was caused by acts that would constitute criminal violations, right? And again, if the legislature wants to specify what types of actions could be brought, the legislature can do that, but didn't do so here.
Your Honor, the legislature, the violation, is not talking about that the action has to be a criminal violation. It's talking about what the statute says. It all talks about violations of a various sexual nature against a minor. And those are the actions that can be brought against the perpetrator, whether it's intentional tort, whether it's a civil, whether it's in some other cause of action.
Counsel?
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
I can, Your Honor.
Thank you. I just want to clarify what the claim is here, because mm-hmm. the claim is not made against the sexual abuser, the person who committed the sexual assault. It's against AAU. And the allegation, as I understand it, is that AAU was negligent in its hiring and supervision of the perpetrator, correct?
That is the allegation as pled in the complaint, Your Honor.
So the act that we're talking about is not the act of sexual assault or sexual abuse. It's AAU's act of negligent hiring and supervision, correct?
That is correct.
Is that your argument?
That is in
and
part.
In the sta-
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
No, I'm sorry.
Go
I cut
ahead.
You off.
And an action is simply a lawsuit, correct? An action to recover damages refers to another word for lawsuit, right?
Action as utilized in 587 is referring to a lawsuit.
So is it your argument then that this statute only applies to an action that would be against the sexual perpetrator?
Yes, Your Honor, that is my argument. In large part, that is the argument of AAU because of the plain language of the statute. If the statute had intended to include other parties, if it intended to include negligence causes of action against non-secular, non-abusing entities or individuals, it could have done so. But the legislature, through the course of its amendments, through the course of the evolution of this statute, has inserted and included very limited, very clearly enumerated limitations as to what this statute would be applicable to. And that is our argument, that AAU is involved, excuse me, strike that, the AAU is being sued on an independent cause of action, negligence, not an intentional tort, not a sexual violation, not perpetrating a sexual assault on a minor. And that is, in essence, what AAU's argument is with respect to why this statute, as written and as passed and as existing today, is not applicable to it.
You keep talking about how specific the statute is, but it just seems to me that if the legislature were doing all that you're telling us it would do, the statute would read an action to recover damages for injury caused by the perpetrator of an act that would constitute a violation of 948.02 or 948.025. It just says an act. It doesn't say who caused the act. And you keep talking about how specific it is, and I've reviewed the history of the statute as well. But it doesn't say what you're saying it says.
The face of the statute, Your Honor, says an act that would constitute a violation. The act that would constitute a violation is a perpetrator's sexual assault of a minor. That's the act. And that's what.
And AAU, counsel, has not, there's no allegation against AAU that it committed an act that would constitute a violation of the various offenses outlined in 948 specified in the statute.
That is correct, Your Honor. In the complaint, there is no allegations about AAU or any representative of AAU doing that.
If it did include a broader range of individuals, why would 895.442 be necessary, the clergy and religious organization statute?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, if you're saying if it was a broader statute, what's the purpose of 442?
Right.
Your point's well taken, Your Honor, because if it was an all-expansive statute that would include broader individuals, such as the church, such as religious organizations,
right?
It would be superfluous. And as Your Honors all know, the legislature does not pass superfluous and extraneous legislation.
All the time the legislature does belts and suspenders, right? I mean, truly, we have so many examples of that. So why, I mean, that's the first question. My second question is, what about constitutional avoidance, and how do you respond to the other side's, your opponent's claim that if we read the statute the way you want us to read it, we're allowing this type of lawsuit for negligent supervision against just religious organizations and not anyone else?
Your Honor, and I apologize, I didn't catch your first question.
The first question was about belts and suspenders. Is there anything else? The first question is, can you point to anything else, legislative history-wise, that supports your argument? And I get that we're reading the statute differently in terms of its plain language, other than this addition of the second part, which could be belts and suspenders, as the legislature often does.
Your Honor, with respect to the legislative history, I think it's very indicative of the legislature's intent that this was to be applicable in a very narrowly construed, very limited fashion to the enumerated claims. The initial statute of 587 was passed in 1987, and it was limited to cases of incest. And the court in Pritzlaff had indicated that there are special discovery rules that are created for the cases in an effort to provide adequate protection to children who have been harmed due to a violation of a very special relationship. In that case, a parent to a minor child. The statute was next amended in 2001, and at that time, the legislature, giving it due consideration and due thought, added the five enumerated statutes that are in the statute today. But it limited to that. And if the court wanted to at that time open it up to all potential claimants, perpetrators as well as non-perpetrators, that would be the opportunity to do it. But they took very specific statutes, all of which deal with the perpetrator's actions only. None of those enumerated statutes, particularly 984.02, and 948.025 have anything in there that says perpetrator and employer, perpetrator and principal, perpetrator and anyone else. They're limited to that. And then we get the third amendment, which was in 2003, where the legislature, again, taking very careful deliberation and knowing what has come before, did not expand it to any and all comers. They could have easily have said any and all claims of sexual assault will be given this statute of repose. They didn't. Instead, what they did, they carved out a very narrow exception to essentially cover religious organizations that employ perpetrators of sexual assault on a minor.
Is that 442? Is that what you're
That's 442,
about?
Your Honor.
So it's really not an amendment of, it's not a third amendment of 587. It was an amendment of the statutes to create 442.
I'm sorry, 442 was amended. 587 was amended in 2003 to incorporate the language of 442, which is limited to clergy and the religious organizations that employ the clergy. And, Your Honor, to answer your second question, the quote that I just gave in Pritzlaff somewhat addresses the constitutionality issue of why only the religious organizations. And the courts have determined in the Akers case and other cases that the legislature can pass statutes that are have different impacts on similarly situated individuals if there is a rational basis for doing so. And the cases do talk about, much like the parent-child relationship, the special relationship that the church and the clergy has with minor individuals and why those relationships warrant special protection, special exception. Not only the trust and support that families and children give to the priest, the area of deference. There was, in one of the cases, they talked about the blind deference, the blind devotion to the church, and that could impact the ability to for a minor child to report the claim, and that's why the expansive period of repose of 35, up to the age of 35 was granted. That is not a constitutional limitation.
And you think that's different than the relationship a child and a family have with coaches?
And AAU was not a coach, Your Honor.
Well, organizations that provide athletics to our children who are participating in those types of things, that would get around any kind of constitutional claim.
It is our contention that AAU did not provide the coach to this organization. But let's assume hypothetically that it had. That is something for the legislature to determine, because anything could then be bootstrapped into a special relationship. But that is somewhat attenuated because AAU did not employ Mr. Kincaid and did not they were not involved in that process.
Counsel, isn't that what this lawsuit at least alleges, negligent supervision? Do you agree that negligent supervision is a separate and distinct tort that can stand on its own legs without any derivative reference?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. It is an independent action. It has separate elements, and it is focused on the actions and omissions, potentially, of the employer, in this case, AAU. And I'm using that term loosely, but for the employer.
Counsel?
Yes.
I want to return to the words of 893-587. And I want to walk through those words. Good thing it's kind of short. and end up with a question regarding constitutionality concerns. Okay. So, an action, okay, and I think you would, let me make sure you have that in front of you.
Do
you?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
An action to recover damages. I think we have that here, right? It's a complaint doesn't sue the perpetrator of the sexual assault acts in the complaint, but it does set forth a cause of action at the beginning for negligent supervision. Do you agree with that?
I apologize, Ryan. I don't think I followed that.
Okay. I was too nuanced. Do you agree that there is an action to recover damages here?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you do. And that action is one of negligent supervision, which is an independent tort action.
Yes.
And it's an action for injury caused by an act. So far, I think you agree that it is an action for injury caused by an act, that act being negligent supervision. Am I correct?
Not as it's interpreted in the entirety of the statute.
That's right. I'm not there yet.
Okay.
Okay.
In the abstract, Your Honor, if that were pled in the complaint, yes.
Yeah. And your problem is that the way you interpret the rest of that clause is that would constitute a violation of the child sexual assault things. And so that's not the kind of act that we're talking about here. You see the rest of that clause as modifying a specific criminal offense, and you're saying there's no specific criminal offense with regard to a negligent supervision cause of action. I think that's your position. I don't mean to be tricking you. I think
that is, Your Honor. What we're basically saying is that the act, and when you take the entirety of the clause, the act is the wrongful conduct of the perpetrator. The damages do not define what the action is. Yeah. It's the act of the perpetrator.
That's what I... Now, your opposing counsel says, well, if you take that interpretation, then the rest of this long sentence, after the or would create a cause of action under what we're referring to as 442, shall be commenced, etc. And your opposing counsel, in looking at 895.442, says, if you interpret the way you do, this 893.587 causes a constitutional issue of treating secular versus non-secular. That causes me to pause a lot. You seem to think no big deal. But if when you were talking about that your organization doesn't supply the coach, I think of the Boy Scouts. That's another secular organization. Let's use that. I mean, doesn't a cause of action against the Boy Scouts, how does that fare in your interpretation here?
One issue, Your Honor, is the Boy Scouts have, that would be more of a respondent superior argument, a derivative claim, because the Boy Scouts as an entity would have a Boy Scout master, say, that would be in direct contact with the individuals.
But didn't AAU hired Mr. Blue, correct?
No.
What was Mr. Blue's relationship with AAU?
None. Mr. Kincaid was the abuser.
No, I know, but Stephen Blue, Fleming alleged that the supervisory employee of AAU, who is Stephen Blue, I mean, you're acting like AAU, like you shouldn't even be in this room. And the reason you're in this room is because Stephen Blue was an employee, worked for AAU, and he was supposed to be supervising Sheldon Kincaid, and he was aware that Kincaid had been convicted of sexual assault of a minor in the early 1990s. And Fleming alleged that she was assaulted by Kincaid multiple times during AAU-sponsored events between 97 and 2000. That's why you're, and I'm reading from your brief. I'm reading from your brief on page 12.
On which page, Your Honor? I'm sorry. I can tell you that Mr. Blue was not an employee of AAU. I'm not sure if that was alleged in the complaint. I was trying to look very quickly, but I could not find it. But I can tell you that Mr. Blue was not an AAU employee. I believe he was with one of the governmental agencies in the county of Dane, school district or the county, who was initially represented by other counsel and dismissed from the case early on.
I don't know if you're finished. Are you finished, Mrs. Karaski?
I am. Thank you.
I wanted to push back on your answer about the Boy Scouts. If there was a negligent supervision claim here, you said, oh, that would be a respondeat superior. But our jury instructions on negligent supervision 1383 civil and also the comments indicate, look, and I think you're halfway there, that negligent supervision is something different than, is to be distinguished from respondeat superior. So I don't find your answers persuasive.
Your Honor, that is my position, that negligent hiring and supervision is independent, because derivative claims are claims that do not have their own elements distinct from a negligence claim to which it attaches. Negligent hiring and negligent supervision has absolutely claims and elements that are distinct from any claim that would be brought against the abuser. It is an independent claim, and it is not derivative.
That's right, and it doesn't have to be respondeat superior, whether it's the Boy Scouts of America or any other entity.
Your time is up.
My time is up.
Give me an answer, though.
And I missed the very last part, Your Honor.
It doesn't have to be under a claim of respondeat superior, whether it's against the Boy Scouts of America or any other entity.
It does not have to be respondeat superior, but under 587, it has to be a perpetrator of a sexual act on a minor, and the Boy Scout, that Boy Scout master would be the one charged with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jeff Herman from Herman Law on behalf of Plaintiff Fleming. If I could just pick up where you just left off with this discussion about a negligence cause of action. And so in all these cases where, whether it's the Boy Scouts or a school or a church, or in this case AAU, where there's the allegation of negligent hiring, retention, and supervision, those are all independent torts. They are not typically respondeat superior claims. To be a respondeat superior claim, you'd have to allege that the abuse was in the course and scope of employment. But what's important about an independent tort of negligence is that there's two cause-in-fact requirements. Number one, there has to be the acts or omissions of the employer, of the principal, causing injury, which is the second cause-in-fact, which is the tort committed by the perpetrator. And so that is how this court has always looked and analyzed negligence.
Typical negligent hiring or supervision case has a statute of limitations of what?
3 years.
Okay. If then someone commits a sexual assault, that statute of limitations now is 35 years under
Correct.
Your theory.
Correct.
So basically no one can ever hire anyone who's been convicted of this kind of crime because...
Or should they?
All right. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I just was trying to make sure I fully understood. It turns 3 years into 35 years if
exactly.
there's a sexual assault.
Exactly. And this was a result of...
Of any business, of any entity, of any organization, of any parent, of anyone. It's 35 years now, right? If you negligently supervised someone and there's a sexual assault, you can be sued for
that
negligent supervision.
Correct. And that was a result of a tremendous effort of victims in 2003 to have the law changed. And it wasn't just for victims of clergy abuse. It was for all victims.
Counsel, could you cite any cases where this statute has been used for lawsuits other than against the perpetrator? It seems like the real question is whether, you know, the act that causes injury, it needs to be an act that constitutes this, and you can only sue the perpetrator, or whether you can, again, have some sort of negligence claim that's not from the perpetrator. And I'm just curious if there's any authority, it doesn't necessarily matter one way, you know, conclusively one way or the other, but I'm curious if you're aware of other states, other cases.
Yes, I'm not aware of any other cases, and I've thought about that, and the answer may be because no other defendant ever challenged this statute of an organization, and so there was never appeals. That's my guess. I don't know. There are no other reported decisions.
Are you aware of any cases where it's being not challenged but just even utilized? I mean, are you aware of any other trial court cases where this is cited to, you know, allow a claim of negligent supervision, or I suppose you could have any other, you know, negligent infliction of emotional distress or something else against non-perpetrators as well, right?
I'm not aware of any other cases.
What's your connection to the organization that you sued for the perpetrator? What's the connection?
Right. So we allege...
Why did they have to supervise them and fail when they didn't?
Well, in the complaint, we allege they had a duty. They had a special relationship, we allege, AAU with the perpetrator, and also a special relationship with the victim.
What was that special relationship?
Well, the perpetrator was a member of AAU, he was authorized, and that they were supervising him. We allege in the complaint that AAU had the duty and was supervising this perpetrator.
Okay, so if it goes back down to the circuit court and they find there's no duty, you're just out of court.
Well, yeah, if there's no, I mean, we have a negligence claim, so of course we would have to prove a duty.
The problem is the connection. That's what I'm having trouble with. What's your connection? Why not sue somebody else? Why not sue somebody in Dane County or some other county? Why?
Right. Well, taking the complaint as pled, that is not an issue in this case. We have alleged that there was a duty, a special relationship, but factually speaking, as we lay out in the complaint, AAU was in charge of this coach, and that they were supervising him. They knew AAU, he was sort of licensed, not a license, but impractical, a license, and they knew he was a child molester. And so the sufficiency of the allegations have to be taken as true. The real issue before this court is whether or not the case was filed timely.
Newer should have known, right?
Newer should have known, yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a basic negligence claim. And they knew or should have known he was unsafe.
That's why you come back to you can't hire these people, right?
In this case, we allege they knew that this other individual at AAU was aware of his background. But yeah, there is a very high duty we expect organizations who are in charge of children to undertake and to make sure kids are going to be safe.
But why would it be limited like that? I mean, it could be, anyway, sorry, you've already answered my questions, I think.
Okay, so I'd like to address...
I just have one other, I want to talk about 895-442, and I had a difficult time understanding your argument about it. I wonder if you could just help me understand it. Is I understand AAU's argument that this at least suggests the incorporation of this into the statute of repose or limitation. There's argument about that, but at least suggests that it wasn't understood to cover these types of negligent supervision claims. Your response, as I understood it a little bit in the briefs, was that it somehow made religious organizations and secular organizations on the same level, and I just didn't understand that. I wondered if
sure.
you could help me.
Yes. Let me take you through, if I could. So we start really with the Pritzlaff case, which this court held was a case against a church, and this court held that the church could not be held liable for a negligence supervision or hiring because of the First Amendment. In fact, there had never been a case in Wisconsin that had set out and recognized the independent claim for an employer or an organization of negligent hiring and supervision. Then we have the Walmart case, which actually clarified and said, no, there always has been this common law understanding, and we do recognize now that there is a negligence claim. So at that point, it's clear under Wisconsin law that employers could be held liable for negligence. What was still unclear, though, was whether or not the church would be protected by the First Amendment if they were negligent in supervising a priest, for example. And so when the amendment, 893.587 was added in 442, the purpose was to make clear that, no, Pritzlaff would not protect a church, and that churches could be held liable for negligence in a child sexual abuse situation, just like lay organizations could be.
I don't understand that. If this court said it is unconstitutional to have certain types of, at least the claim in Pritzlaff was. A statute can't remedy that problem.
Well, I think it had been recognized prior to that, and this was true across the country. There were many cases, many Supreme Courts around the country recognizing that, no, the claim of a negligence against a church that hires a predator priest does not invoke First Amendment issues. It is neutral. It's the same law that would apply to the Boy Scouts or to the AAU or to a school. And so there was discussion by this court in other cases saying that, well, maybe the First Amendment doesn't protect the church in those kind of cases. And this, so I don't think it was unconstitutional. I think it just codifies and recognizes that principle and just made it clear so that the church could not raise First Amendment issues if they were sued for negligence. That was the purpose of the amendment in 2003 to add 442. But that had nothing to do with whether or not lay organizations were liable potentially in those claims. And I want to address this constitutional issue because this is the elephant in the room here. It would be absurd, as the courts have used this word, to have a statute interpreted the way AAU wants to interpret it that says, if you're going to sue a lay organization, you have 3 years. But the church, we're going to give you until the victim's 35 years old.
That might be an issue for another case another day if a church or archdiocese or whoever wanted to challenge that. I'm understanding Justice Rebecca Bradley wants to ask a question. She's on the phone, so yes. I'd like to give her that opportunity if possible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Counsel, I'd like to get back to the language of 893-587, an action to recover damages for injury caused by an act that would constitute a violation of the criminal statutes that criminalize sexual assault. As I understand it, and I'm looking at your complaint, you're alleging as a direct and proximate result of AAU's negligence, your client has suffered severe injuries, including emotional distress. So as I understand your claims, you have brought an action to recover damages for injury caused by negligence, not an act that would constitute a violation of the statutes that criminalize sexual assault. Is that accurate?
Well, there's two acts that are part of the negligence claim. So, and this court has held that you have to have two cause in fact acts. You have to have the act of the employer, and you also have to have the act of the employee or the agent committing the wrongful conduct. And so because that satisfies the second element, this claim would not exist but for the acts that violate these enumerated statutes of sexual abuse. They are, it fits exactly with what the statute is saying. I mean, a plain reading of the statute makes it, I think, crystal clear that it's not limited to claims against perpetrators. It would have said that if it was limited. It is not limiting at all. It just identifies the cause of injury has to be a sexual abuse that would fit the definition of Wisconsin law. And so in order to find the interpretation the AAU wants, we actually have to twist the statute, ignore the plain meaning of it, and then make a finding that it's unconstitutional. I understand that would be an argument for another day, but one of the tenets of statutory interpretation is for the court to look for an interpretation that does not violate the Constitution because the legislature would not do so. And so, yes,
but counsel, we cannot rewrite statutes to avoid constitutional problems. And I understand that you've raised that in your briefing, but there is no claim by anybody that this statute is unconstitutional because, of course, this organization is not a religious one, right?
Well, that's correct. But my point is that there is a reasonable interpretation of this statute that completely avoids that issue.
I'm not sure I am seeing your point. I see what you're I think I see what you're trying to do, but I'm having trouble getting beyond the fact that the act here is negligence by AAU. They did not commit, an organization obviously did not commit a sexual assault, and this statute is very specific in invoking the sexual assault statute.
Well, let me, if I could run through the statute as it's written, because I think it's important to read the entire statute in context. So what it says, and this is exactly what I believe the plaintiff is bringing here, it's an action to recover damages, which is what Fleming is bringing, an action to recover damages for an injury, which she has, an injury, caused by an act. Okay, she's alleging her injury was caused by an act that would constitute a violation of the sex abuse statutes. It's the statute doesn't, by its terms, limit the action to get to just claims against the perpetrator. It leaves that completely open-ended. So all it's saying is that in order to benefit from the statute, you have to have been sexually abused. And it defines sexually abused abuse as a under definition of the criminal statutes.
Counsel, how important is it that a cause of action for negligent supervision, in order to be maintained, requires two acts? That's not the norm. You know, there may be certainly other examples, but it requires two acts, right?
Yes.
Requires the independent tort of negligent hiring, supervision, etc. And then it requires, clearly under the law and under, it requires a second act, which is predicated, that gives life to the negligent supervision claim. So, unlike most tort claims, where you have someone doing some negligent action that caused the injury. You know, that's the standard tort claim allegation and the complaint. Here you have to, in order, because of the unique nature of a negligent supervision claim, you're talking about two different acts. You have to have two different acts.
Yes.
And point to me the language in the statute upon which you rely, that the last, that the words that would constitute an act that would constitute a violation can mean either of the two acts or only one of the two acts, or how do you interpret that?
Sure.
And I take into consideration the uniqueness of negligence supervision requiring two acts in order to maintain a cause of action.
Right. So in a negligence claim, as you said, you need the two acts.
Negligence supervision. Normally you need just negligence caused injury, period.
Correct. Done. I'm sorry. Yes, negligence supervision, retention, or hiring. So there's a requirement to have the underlying tort committed, in this case, of the abuse. And so the statute says, the language says, this is where an action to recover damages for injury, okay, caused by an act. So the question is, was Fleming's injury caused by the child sexual abuse? And it was. Now, there also is wrongdoing on the part of the of AAU that enabled this to happen.
See, I see it differently. I see it more nuanced. The injury-causing act vis-a-vis defendant here is the negligent supervision, right? Isn't that the injury-causing act?
Okay. So the negligent supervision encompasses...
Go ahead.
So as this court has said, a negligent supervision claim encompasses both acts, the act on omissions of the employer and the intentional tort of the employee perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And so when you say negligent supervision, you are inherently including the intentional tort committed by the perpetrator.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And the and in order to buttress that argument, whether it's right or wrong, you know, you'll find out. Stay tuned. Bring into the discussion that concern about interpreting secular versus religious, right?
Correct.
To avoid constitutional avoidance.
That's correct, and correct, and that is a tenet of statutory interpretation that this court mm-hmm. can and I believe should consider. There is a reasonable interpretation based upon the plain reading of the statute that has a legitimate, reasonable, non-constitutionally violating interpretation. And I'll go back again to the legislative history, which was to add in this 442 so that religious organizations were placed on an equal footing with lay organizations. It wasn't to make it worse for religious organizations. In light of Pritzlaff, the legislature wanted to treat religious organizations the same when it comes to child sex abuse as non-religious organizations. I don't think it's reasonable to say they went from a First Amendment question, so all of a sudden, now we're going to treat them worse. The legislature clearly would have recognized that that would be impermissible to do.
Just if you're right, though, about the reading of the statute, that it already included constitutionally permissible negligent supervision claims against any organization, I don't understand why they would have put that in there.
Because of Pritzlaff.
But they can't overrule a constitutional decision via statute. That's what I don't understand. If there is already a common law recognized right of negligent supervision, that action which we recognized in 1998, this is amended later, and the statute means what you say it means, then the statute already would have recovered that same claim. So it already would have applied. So I'm trying to figure out what we make of the fact that the legislature chose to put it in there, but if you're right, they didn't need to.
Well, perhaps they didn't need to, but I am pretty sure that if 442 wasn't in there and the church was sued in Wisconsin for a priest molesting a child after 3 years, using the statute, the church, or sued in any event, without regard to statute of limitations, the church would make a First Amendment defense. And I think that it makes it much more clear to have 442 in there. And we know that because...
Look at the statute that can't... The statute can't override a constitutional decision. And I presuming the legislature didn't try to override a decision rooted in the Constitution. I don't understand that argument.
Well, I think statutes codify common law all the time. That's not unheard of. And so it's simply arguably codifying what was already accepted in the common law. I agree they can't make something constitutional that's not. But this is a recognition of there was, after Pritzlaff, there was never a clear ruling on the First Amendment issue with churches. There was discussions by this court that it would not, First Amendment probably would not protect the church from these claims. I think that just codifies that.
If you're right, is there anything in 442, 895-442, that is not already covered by your interpretation of the statute? If that language had never been put in there, does it serve any purpose at all?
I'm going to rely on my brief. I do believe we have a discussion on there about maybe it may expand a little bit about the fiduciary duties or the special duties. But I would argue and accept your point that I don't think it really grants more rights than under the common law. I think you'd have the same arguments outside the First Amendment potential defense. I do believe that without it, without the First Amendment issue, that religious organizations would be able to be sued the same
as the organization. So is it fair to summarize your argument, counsel, is that, and it's fine, sometimes the legislature does, as Justice Dowd suggested, do a boots and suspenders type thing. But that's functionally your argument, that mostly that was surplusage because it was already covered by the language of the statute.
I agree.
Not entirely.
Yes, okay. I agree.
Can you talk to me a little bit? Are you done?
I am. Go ahead.
Okay. 893.54.1MA provides that the action to recover damages for injuries is commenced within 3 years. You already said that to me. Then you have 893.16 that would apply here because this was a minor, right? And that would then extend it until age 20. So that would have allowed this particular plaintiff to bring this cause of action by 2004, right?
Yes.
And then what is that statute for if it's really 35 years old, or is it just in sexual assault cases the 20 years doesn't apply, 20 years old doesn't apply? In sexual assault cases, you fast forward to 35 years.
Correct. It's strictly for sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse cases, which is consistent with what states across the country have done, have expanded that statute of limitations.
States across the country have expanded liability to entities other than religious organizations, entities. I thought your answer to Justice Hagedorn earlier was that you don't know of any other lawsuits that have survived against an entity.
I'm sorry, I thought that was in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah.
So around
maybe
the United
States. Maybe I misunderstood
your
question.
It was, but I'm interested to hear your answer to the Chief Justice.
Yeah, sure.
Around the United States, it's commonplace that the wording of the statute has been expanded to entities to create liability for 35 years?
Not the exact wording of the statute, but the concept of extending the statute of limitations for victims of childhood sexual abuse has been expanded around the country.
Well, we have done that. I mean, that is here because you have until age 20 under 893.16. The issue is whether or not you have until age 35 under the other provision.
Right. Many states have created, extended it to 55 years old. And in these other states, I'm not aware of any distinction between religious and lay organizations.
Yeah, I get that, but we don't have the religious organization. Maybe we are called upon to decide the constitutionality of that statute at a different time, but that's not today. What today is whether or not 893.16 is the applicable statute, or whether or not the one you're arguing for 35 years old is the applicable statute. And you're saying courts around the country in a statute like 597 have expanded liability. It wasn't a statute like 893.16.
Correct.
Okay, I'm having problems connecting your claim to the organization that you sued. You could have sued Cherokee Middle School, but apparently chose not to. In paragraph 12, it is alleged that Stephen Blue, who was Kincaid's supervisor, was aware that he'd been convicted. But there's nothing in the complaint that says the AAU hired Stephen Blue. So that doesn't connect him. And then later on in the complaint, paragraph 40 says, defendant AAU further failed to conduct background screening of its coaches to determine if they have been convicted of sexually abusing children. But there's nothing in the complaint that says Kincaid was the hiree or the coach of the AAU. I'm having trouble connecting the claim you make to the organization that you sued.
Sure. So I'll run through a couple of the relevant paragraphs.
Thank you.
Here.
Thank you.
Paragraph 11, we allege Kincaid applied for and became a member and or a volunteer with defendant AAU by and through his role as the coach of the Madison Spartans. And then we alleged in 12, as you said, Kincaid's supervisor during the course of his tenure was Stephen Blue, and Kincaid and Blue was aware Kincaid was convicted.
There's nothing that connects Blue to the AAU. Tell me where, besides paragraph 12, you're connecting Blue to the AAU. I didn't find it, and I have the complaint here, and I was just looking for it again. So.
Yeah. I'd have to look through all.
I thought Blue was a supervisory employee of AAU.
Yes, that's, I'm just looking for
him. Paragraph 12 is the only thing I have that has his name in there. So. Well, that's okay. I don't want to take up all your time, but I'm not connecting your claim to the party you sue.
Well,
I'm at the very basic level here, much lower down than we're talking about here with interpreting the statute.
Well, even leaving Blue out, we allege that that the AAU had a duty to supervise the perpetrator Kincaid. We allege that AAU was aware. I'm sorry.
I thought Blue was important because he's the one who knew about the prior sexual assaults.
That would make AAU aware. That's correct. But I'm just saying, in terms of the pleading, we do allege in here. I mean, we do talk about Blue, and I haven't gone through the whole complaint to find Blue again. But we do allege that AAU was aware, should have been aware, that Kincaid engaged in sexual misconduct. Obviously, AAU would be aware through its employees or its agents. But we are alleging that AAU had knowledge. In the complaint, that
someone in
my
the
time's
AAU.
Up, but I'm
you
happy.
You may finish your answer.
Thank you. We allege that in paragraph 40 that they failed to conduct a background screening of the coaches to determine if he was convicted. Had a background screening of Kincaid been conducted, he would not have been in position to sexually abuse Jane Doe, and that's without regard to Blue. We're alleging a negligent hiring. He's a convicted sexual offender who's never been hired or authorized to be a coach. That establishes a negligent hiring claim under Wisconsin law. And there's numerous paragraphs in there talking about the special duties and the relationship. So I think we have that covered.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, we didn't talk about 893.13, and I wanted to just quickly touch base on that. In your briefing, you argued that you can't equitably toll a statute of repose. You argued it was a statute of repose. But what would be the problem with statutorily tolling a statute of repose? Do you have any authority for the notion that you cannot have a statute that does that?
We do have, Your Honor, the proposition that a statute of repose sets a hard and fast deadline as to beyond which a claim cannot be brought versus a statute of limitation that begins to run on the accrual of the knowledge that they knew or should have known of the injury. So under the concept of statute of repose, the legislature sets a hard date which cannot be told equitably or otherwise.
I'm asking to drill down a little on what Justice Hagedorn just asked you. Where does it say that? I look at our history of the legislature's history of talking about repose and statute of limitations almost interchangeably. There's one statute that actually talks about statute of repose, and otherwise it appears to be more of a judicial terminology. So where do you get the concept that a statute can't toll a statute of repose?
And, Your Honor, thank you. I do believe this may be an issue of first impression. I could not find any cases directly on point, but it's based upon the concept of a statute of repose, which sets a firm final deadline beyond which, for purposes of public policy, for purposes of protecting, not only there's certain benefits to the plaintiff, but there's also certain public policy arguments for the defendant that after a certain period of time, due to the staleness of claims, due to the death or disappearance of witnesses, the overall paucity of evidence, it becomes difficult to defend a case, which is one of the reasons why we had argued, based upon the concept of statute of repose, based upon the clear indications in the statute that it is a final, firm, and hard date.
How do you fit that into 28 U.S.C. 1367 sub D, which allows for tolling while a claim is pending in federal court and for 30 days afterwards unless the state law provides at that point?
I think that tolling is tolling of the statute of limitations. So if there is a limitations issue, but I don't believe that that statute or the concomitant Wisconsin provision that has similar language applies to a repose because, again, the legislature set an outside date beyond which a claim cannot be filed.
Doesn't moving out of state toll statutes running in this kind of a context? For instance, we had a case of a priest from Chicago who would come to southern Wisconsin and engage in sexual acts with young boys. And I think that case addressed the tolling of the statute because of jurisdiction. We didn't have jurisdiction. I might be wrong. That's my recollection. If I'm correct, how does that fit into your argument about statutory tolling?
If I may clarify, Your Honor, was that a tolling of the statute of limitations, or is the court tolling a repose?
I don't know for sure, but I'm thinking it's repose because it was years and years had passed.
It would be dependent upon the nature, because if it was a limitations tolling, the law does allow for, and the statutes that Justice Dellett had just referenced, I think would be applicable. But when we're dealing with a statute of repose, where the legislature set a final date mm-hmm. beyond which, for whatever reason, due to its repressed memories, whether it's due to failure to discover for whatever other reasons, that sets a firm date. And even though it may not be the most equitable, it cuts off the period of time.
It's your turn.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. There's time left, I'll wrap up.
Sounds good. I want to talk to you a little bit about 89316. That is the under age 18 extension of time that extends the 3 years or an action will be barred. It's in 893. In this case, it would extend it to, I think, 2004 when this particular individual turned 20 years old. Sub 5 of that section says the section applies to statutes in this chapter limiting the time for commencement of action or assertion of defense or counterclaim, except it does not apply to, and then under B, it lists a whole host of statutes that this limitation doesn't apply to, and notably absent from that is 893, same chapter, 587. Why do you think 893-587 isn't excluded in the 20-year-old limitation?
May I answer, Your Honor? My time's expired.
You may answer.
If I'm understanding it, I don't have the statute in the below me, but I think what you're saying is that 587 was not included as providing an exception to the 3-year statute of limitation plus the 2-year for under 893.16.
Well, it's more than 2 years you get to, but anyway.
Yes.
When you're a minor, not otherwise disabled, it's a different extension, which here would extend it
and Your Honor,
to 2004 or 20 years old, 2 years beyond 18.
Yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting. I think the reason is very telling is that the legislature and the statute is not applicable to 893.16. 0.587. It's excluded, and that is consistent with Doe 1, where Doe 1 found, after the analysis, at paragraph 18, that the three-year statute of limitations for negligent hiring and supervision is applicable.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for interesting oral arguments. Safe travels to all of you. The court will convene a conference at 1:30.